Welcome to the Vampire Castle, the only podcast where I, Jamie Peck,
and I, Leslie III,
talk about all things vampirical, sexy, and cool.
How do you think vampires are dealing with both the COVID crisis as well as, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement coming back? And now, like, how do vampires feel now that we're celebrating, you know, Juneteenth? All the banks and the companies and the corporations are now acknowledging Juneteenth. How do vampires feel now, given the fact that so many of them probably owned slaves at some point?
That's an excellent and topical question. I think it really depends on what vampires we're talking about. Obviously, if it's the capitalist vampires from the Blade movies,
yes.
They're probably big Trump supporters. They're probably posting memes about Antifa.
See, you know, I'm not sure because maybe, you know, I feel like those vampires, they were very, you know, even though they were extremely classist, there was diversity on that vampire panel. That was a very diverse panel of capitalist vampires. So maybe they're all like reading White Fragility right now, or at least telling their minions to read it for them and tell them the bullet points in order for them to deal with this. And I'm sure all the corporations and the banks that they own will be, you know, taking a half day tomorrow to commemorate Juneteenth.
Yeah, maybe they brought in that White Fragility lady to do like a corporate seminar for their captive employees about how not to do racism. It's very possible they're like all in for Biden as well.
Yes.
They're like, they're neoliberals, you know? Maybe they're divided. I don't know.
It gets getting into dangerous territory. But of the billionaire political class that we know of, which of them do you think is most likely to be an actual vampire?
Oh, well, I mean, we already know about Peter Thiel.
Yes,
right?
We know about Peter Thiel, but it feels like that may be a fake, like he's trying to be a vampire because he met one and they wouldn't let him in the club, so he's trying to become a vampire on his own.
I mean, Bezos is a pretty good candidate, right?
Yes, but I think he's more of a cyborg, actually, personally. I think if you look, you know, I believe you can tell he has a cybernetic eye. If you look at his old pictures versus new pictures, he got a new cybernetic eye installed at some point. He's more of a tech type vampire. My thought was that just from his appearance alone, Mark Zuckerberg quite possibly was a vampire infiltrator who decided at one point to Ivy League school and, you know, get in on the tech boom at the ground floor. That's why his face looks so like, he looks like Data from Star Trek. I think that would explain a lot if Zuckerberg was himself a vampire who decided to go public.
Ugh, that's like such a big insult to vampires. Like vampires are
usually
sexy,
aren't nerds.
Cool.
Yeah. Look, there have to be nerd as vampires, right? That's the thing. Your society can't function if you don't have like the tech dweebs to like make the blood drinking app or whatever, your blood delivery app service. Like who is making the DoorDash for like vampires? And it would be nerd vampires, I think.
Yeah. No, you're probably right. And all of the elder vampires are like, you know, they're like, oh, Zuckerberg, what a fucking piece of shit. He could never hang out in our cool vampire club. But they still use his app to get blood delivered to their doors. But I definitely think that the working class vampires from The Lost Boys would be like all in on this uprising.
Oh,
they're
yes.
going to be marching down by the pier in Santa Clara saying Black Lives Matter.
Oh, they are definitely part of it. They're the white anarchists that we were warned about. But they're actually, you know, comrades in arms, I think. I think they're willing to take the system down, whatever that system is at the time. They'll be fighting against it.
Oh yeah, comrades in fangs, if you will. I would be very happy to have them on our side for sure.
Yes.
We need all the help we can get.
Yes. Today on Vampire Castle, we're talking about two movies, you know, one that's become like in the past few years, like a horror classic. And everyone, you know, recommends this movie as one of the, thinks about this film as one of the best horror films of all time. That's, Let the Right One In, by Thomas Alfredson. It's a Swedish horror film, which was remade, in America as, Let Me In. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about the remake.
Oh, I did not know about the remake. Why? Why would you do that to this beautiful Swedish film?
I can look, if you watch the remake, you can understand why they made some changes to make it a little bit more palatable to American audiences. It's a little bit more over the top with the horror, but on the whole, it's worth the, you know, discussing that second. But you're quite right that the first one is very good in its own right. And Jamie, it was your idea to pair Let the Right One In with a film that I really enjoy, but not a lot of people talk about, from 2012. And funnily enough, it's directed by Neil Jordan, who directed one of the most well known, perhaps the most well known modern vampire film, in Interview with the Vampire. He made another vampire movie and no one cared or paid attention for some reason, and that's Byzantium, starring Saoirse Ronan and Gemma Arterton. Just like Interview with the Vampire, it's, you know, this long generational tale of these two relations and how they deal with each other over the centuries and bringing someone new into the fold. And both these films kind of tie together because they're also kind of teen romance vampire films that don't suck, thankfully.
Indeed. Like, they're definitely movies about teenage love. They're definitely movies about growing up, which brings up the question, if you get turned into a vampire when you're still a kid or a teenager, are you just always coming of age? Because that sounds exhausting.
Yes. Like, because you're, you know, your brain's still developing, your hormones are still going wild. Does that just stay that way forever? I guess it depends on the type of vampire. I think some vampires, sometimes we see that you mature mentally, but you not physically, and that kind of fucking fucks you up, and that's why you're not allowed to make child vampires in the Anne Rice novels. Sometimes you get that, you know, they're always like little evil children forever. I think that the Near Dark vampire, he was still a child, but he was just like a really fucking evil one.
Yeah, child vampires are so creepy.
Yeah.
They're old souls, and yet they still, you know, they're still teens on some level. I was talking about this with my friend last night, actually. Like, 12 is way too young to be turned into a vampire. I would not want to be 12 forever. I think the earliest age that I could maybe deal with it is like 16 or 17, like in Byzantium, you know, like old enough to maybe have sex so you don't have the problem of like Jessica and True Blood, where like every single time you have sex, you lose your virginity all over again and your hymen grows back.
Wait, what?
Oh, yeah. We should do a show on True Blood. It's so dumb, but I watched all of it. That is a one problem that a vampire has on True Blood.
That's so funny.
I know. But I would love to have like the skin of a 16-year-old for all time. Like, that would be fine. Like, as long as you've reached sexual maturity, I think you're fair game to be turned. That's my opinion anyway.
So we're talking about age of consent for vamping someone?
Yeah, I would say so.
Oh, then all the vampires on Buffy are canceled. They were always turning those teens into vampires.
Yeah, well, age of consent, it varies from place to place. And, you know, different people have...
Near the Hellmouth, it's like around like 13, I guess.
Different people have different opinions on how young or how old is old enough to be turned into a blood-sucking nightmare creature for the rest of eternity.
I just thought of the most terrifying two words that you could put together. Vampire libertarian.
Ah, geez. Well, like I said, Peter Thiel, we already know about one of them.
Yeah.
He's not even a libertarian. I think he's just a fucking fascist. Full on. Mask off.
All right. And first up, we have Let the Right One In. It's 2008. And I really enjoy this film. This is actually my first time watching it all the way through. I've tried to watch it before, but I kept falling asleep.
Oh my god, me too.
Yeah, it's a real, and it's because, and it's not because it's a bad movie, but the way it's shot, and this is like its strength too, it's so like stoic and still, and everything is so like desaturated and white. And then that's when the violence actually happens and the sudden movements actually happen. And then, you know, the screen explodes into all this blood or all this fire. It's really, really affecting. But this is not a movie you can watch if you're trying to wind down. You kind of have to be up for it to get through it, at least in my experience.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tend to fall asleep anyway whenever I try to watch anything at night before bed. But this movie, it's definitely got a slower pace, I would say. Lots of long tracking shots of the beautiful snowy landscape in the very nice looking suburb outside of Stockholm where it all takes place. But then that makes the moments of violence like even more shocking when they happen.
Yeah, yeah. This film, when you watch it, it just feels like a real world. It has real world. Even though it's not, you know, it almost has like a documentary type feel without, you know, camera movement, right? It feels like, or maybe like surveillance, you know. A lot of this film's like very voyeuristic and deliberately so, because you're sometimes, you know, the characters are, you know, looking at each other when they don't know that each other is there. Like the boy might spy on the girl might spy on the boy, the neighbors spy on each other because there's a little vampire running around their small town, just straight up murdering people. And this is a very small Swedish town, so like that actually has repercussions, and people notice when like bodies start showing up.
Oh yeah, I mean, I have to imagine, taken together, the murders in this movie are like the most murders they've ever had in Sweden.
Yes. And it's like five, and it's still like all-time high. Like this year would go down in like the history books as like the bloodiest year in Swedish history.
Yeah, certainly in the history of that town.
Yeah.
So let's see. We begin with Oscar, the protagonist, who is he's a bit of a loner. He's getting bullied at school.
Yeah. What makes this film kind of interesting, and what they kind of softened a little bit in the remake, is that we're supposed to think basically that Oscar is like a school shooter or killer. Yeah. In like in development, right? Like a couple more bad things happen to him and he's gonna be a real, you know, problem. The first thing we see, he's playing with a knife and pretending to torture someone, presumably another child at school. And so we're meant to think that even though he is like obviously a victim of bullying, that he is, you know, responding to that by sort of turning into a monster in his own right.
Oh yeah, and he like collects news articles about murders and pastes them in his creepy little book. Like he's definitely kind of a textbook school shooter, or like a school thwacker. Which is, I guess we'll get to that later. But when he hits his bully with a stick, that's like...
He did become a school thwacker. He definitely did that. It takes a while for the stories to fully come together. At the same time, we're following this man that we don't really know who he is or what his name, except we do know that he likes to drug and slit people's throats and drain their blood.
Yeah, he's not very good at it, though.
Yeah.
I just assumed it was a vampire family from the beginning, but then as the movie progresses, you kind of start to ask some questions about who this guy is and what his relationship is to this child vampire.
Yeah, they keep it pretty vague in the Swedish one, and the American one is very explicit. You're supposed to pick up very early on that he's much older than the American one. So him being bad at it is because he's been doing it for so long and he's just tired of doing it. In this one, he just kind of like gives a kind of a fuck up, and he rushes. He tries to bleed someone in like a park, and like a lady comes up with like three dogs, and like the dog is like trying to sniff him while he's trying to drain the body. What was the other fuck up he did?
Where he gets caught. He's trying to do it at the school for some reason.
Or it's like a gym or something. I think maybe it's a public gym, maybe not necessarily a school, but I mean, it might be a school too, but like he isolates like one like popular teen seemingly, and his friends just come back to look for him to find out what's going on, and he's like hanging from the fucking like in the gym, like from the fucking ceiling of the locker room and shit. He's just like stuck there. Like he's very, very bad at it. In the remake, they try to explain away like, oh, he's just gotten really old, and so he can't keep up anymore. But this guy, he's just like shitty. So it kind of makes sense that she's so disappointed in him.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wonder, like, has he ever done this successfully before? And like, why does she keep him around? Because she seems perfectly capable of killing and eating people all by herself.
Yeah. I think we're supposed to think, you know, it's kind of this, you know, codependent relationship where at some point, like she recruited him at some point, he feels obligated towards her, and he's maybe the one that doesn't want her going out and, you know, doing this herself, because she is, even though she's a vampire, she's still kind of small and can, you know, like at one point when she does bite someone, like somebody runs up and just kicks her off. And if he had been more focused, he might, you know, be able to hurt her.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he just doesn't like the idea of this 12-year-old vampire running around attacking people, because it's really creepy.
Oh, I just realized were we misgendering Eli? Because I didn't know, because my wife was telling me, oh, we don't actually know that she's a girl or not.
There's a weird part of it where she says, I'm not a girl. He's like, I want to go steady. Do you want to go steady? Be my girl or whatever. She's like, I'm not a girl. He's like, whatever. Do you want to go steady? And she's like, fine. But yeah, I don't know if it's ever really said.
I think it's meant
really
to be ambiguous, because Eli is played by a girl, but Eli in the story, when she says I'm not a girl, you think, oh, it means because I'm a vampire. But then you see later that Eli doesn't have, you know, genitalia. So I think maybe in the book it says that Eli was actually, you know, castrated at some point. Wow. And was
they do not make that very clear in the movie.
Yeah, it is in the American version. They don't really deal with any of that. They kind of, you know, just shave that edge off for right quick. But that's very, you know, interesting decision for a 2008 horror film.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what should we call Eli going forward?
Is she, they?
Don't want to misgender this child vampire.
No, not at all.
I think, you know what? I think Eli is comfortable with either she or they pronouns. I'm going to go with that.
Okay. They pronouns. Right,
not cool. Not to project onto a fictional child vampire.
No, never.
But certainly Eli lives as a girl and is perceived by the world as a girl and as a human. Many, many layers happening here of identity.
Oh, I was just reading so the novel does say that Eli is an androgynous boy castrated centuries before by a sadistic vampire nobleman.
What? Wow. I got to read this book.
Yeah. If it dives more into the lore, because we don't actually learn a lot about vampires. This is another one of those vampire things where you only ever meet one vampire in it, and you don't really learn too much about like what vampire society or culture is. But I did want to talk a little bit about how Eli and her, you know, keeper live, and it seems to be very, very meager. This is not even though at one point Eli tells the boy that this little egg that they have is worth, you know, as much millions and millions of dollars, is really like all their possessions fit on like a little table.
Yeah. I mean, shout out to Scandinavian social democracy, I suppose, for enabling a vampire and her or their familiar to live a decent life in a nice suburb of Stockholm without seeming to have any source of income besides the random things they're able to steal from the people they kill.
Yeah, like that is some social safety net when you don't have, when neither one of them works and they just roam around the country, like taking whatever cash they can get from their victims. Like, how hard would that be to get? Like, you would not have an apartment that nice if you tried to pull that in America.
Mm-mm. Shout out to Universal Programs making the vampire lifestyle possible.
Yes. A boom for all, you know, drifter killers, actually, mm-hmm, when you really think about it.
Mm-hmm.
As Ellie and Oscar's relationship kind of develops, and her keeper, you know, gets caught and killed, we see that what has been really happening, you know, Oscar thinks he's in a teen romance, but Ellie is actually grooming Oscar to be her new muscle, as it were. And her keeper is, you know, getting older. He's losing his edge, and he finally, you know, ends up dying. She kills him.
Yeah, let's not paper over that part.
Yes, like,
it is brutal the way she gets rid of him.
Yeah, he scars himself with acid, so he can't be identified and tied to Ellie. And then she drains him of blood, and then kicks him out the drops him out the window, like haphazardly
out the window of the hospital.
Yeah, out the window of the hospital, and he's still alive when he hits, and he just kind of sits there and dives in the snow.
Yeah, that was one moment in the movie where I was like, "Damn, this movie's brutal." Harsh realm for that guy.
Another thread that's happening throughout the film is that Ellie is picking off like this drinking gang, like just these regular folks who are just like hang out at the bar with each other, like one by one. She kills them off for blood, and it's like all because I guess we're supposed to think it's like a really, really small town, a small community. So she kills like three people in the same like drinking circle.
These red-faced Swedes, they just can't get enough. They're always drinking glog. They're always walking home drunk. And then she fucks them up. Like, that's another scene that was incredibly brutal when she jumps on the guy, drinks his blood, and then snaps his neck. I'm like, damn, this movie's crazy.
Yeah, it really, you know, the violence in this movie, because it's mostly like so still and so quiet, really stands out. The blood looks wonderful in it because everything else is so, you know, pale and desaturated. The visually stunning scene is the fire scene after Ellie bites a woman, but she manages to survive because her drinking buddy pushes Ellie off, and she ends up, you know, turning into a vampire herself, but she doesn't know it. So when she asked her boyfriend to open up the blinds in the hospital, this is after the cat attack scene, I guess. I don't know if we can skip over the cat attack scene where
crazy.
All those like 12 like CGI cats just rip into this woman because they realize that she's a vampire.
The cats know. Whose house? The cat man is kind of pivotal in this movie too, I think, because he witnesses the first killing but doesn't say anything. And then I got a little confused about which Swedish man was which. I have a little bit of trouble telling them apart. They all have those names. I don't know if that's racist towards Swedish people, but the one guy, I think his name is Loka, really gets a bad deal in this movie because she kills his best friend, and then I think it's his girlfriend maybe who gets like bitten and turned, and I think maybe she knows what she's becoming and that's why she asks for the window to be opened. And then in the end, finally, he like goes over to the vampire's apartment and gets drained for his troubles.
yeah, like all the, like they did, none of them did anything wrong. The woman where she, like that scene in the hospital where the flames just take her is mm-hmm. so brutal. It's so yeah. brutal. And like, and then he finds, you know, Ellie, and he, and like the really interesting thing about that scene, cause he has a knife when he's going in and he sees it's just like this child, and he's, and Oscar comes at him with a knife, and then he throws the knife down because he's not like a bad guy. He's not there to like hurt children. And then he gets murdered, because yeah. he put his knife down because he didn't want to hurt the kids.
Oh yeah. The people in this town are just sitting ducks for vampires. Like, they're always just getting drunk and wandering around by themselves in the snow in remote places, and they're like fundamentally good natured. Like, that's one thing that is, that makes this movie extra brutal, because in some vampire movies there's a sense of justice, like maybe the vampires only kill bad people or people who have it coming in some way, but like, they've only ever tried to be nice and have a nice community. Like, even in the beginning when they invite Vampire Dad to go sit down and have a drink with them. Yeah. I'm like, that's kind of nice. Maybe, but then again, you know, there is a dark side to Swedish society, especially now. Here's me bringing in political economy again, but the world was going through a huge crisis in 2008, and even Scandinavia. That, you know, what we think of as like a very nice kind of social democratic utopia. They had a crisis there. They had a debt crisis. They had a Nazi problem that seemed to get pretty bad right around that time. So maybe the vampire is this specter just haunting the Swedish town.
And it could be because if there's anybody who gets their just desserts for being murdered by the vampire, it's the children. It's the bullies who are bullying Oscar in the final scene of the film, which actually doesn't really show anything, but it's, you know, a really effective scene where, you know, they're basically drowned. They're torturing Oscar by holding his head in the water. And then you just start seeing their body parts floating in the water because Ellie has murdered all of them. Even she just kills like all those little kids, just like straight up murders them. It's really, really brutal. Decapitations, dismemberments, like just the awful violence, but you know, almost entirely off screen. Really, really good stuff, and they deserved it. So maybe, you know, this was a warning saying, you know, all this, you know, these disasters of capitalism will destroy our children eventually.
Yeah,
we'll make them monsters and then destroy them.
Yeah, it's a beautiful scene though. It kind of reminds me of some of the pool scenes in It Follows. Another very scary movie that really fucked me up.
Yeah, and was it The Faculty too? It had a pool scene at the end of it. It was the teen body snatcher film that had a really good pool scene at the end.
Oh yeah, you know, we could do a whole compendium on cool pool scenes in teen horror movies, because I'm sure there's plenty of them.
So that was Let the Right One In. I mean, it's a horror. It was a classic for a reason. It's really, really good. A lot of people don't really like the remake because it does make certain things more obvious and leaves things. There's much less ambiguity in it. But I, having seen it first, maybe it spoiled it for me. But I actually do still enjoy the remake, even now after, you know, seeing the original finally all the way through for the first time.
Yeah, I really liked it too. We didn't even talk about the very end where I guess it's kind of a happy ending if you see the vampire as the protagonist and the kid. Maybe it's not the happiest ending for the kid.
I don't find it as a happy
ending. I feel like
ending.
Oscar could have maybe with a little bit of help from the very nice welfare state they have there gone on to become like a productive member of Swedish society. But instead, he, like, there's that pivotal scene where she's like, we're the same. You want to kill people for revenge. Yeah. I kill people because I need to drink their blood to survive. Just be like me for a while. And he's like, all right. And earlier than that, too, he's like, are you a vampire? And she's like, yeah. And he's like, all right, that's chill. Just, you know, my girlfriend, hang out with me. And then they escape on the train. And I don't know where they're going on the train, but it seems like he's going to be her new familiar for as long as she needs him around. I don't know. Maybe maybe her power worked on me, too, because at the end, I wasn't like, oh, no, he's going to meet a bad end. I was like, oh, that's nice. They're still together.
Oh, no, his life is over. Now he has to, you know, kill for her until, you know, he's no longer of use or he gets called. And then that's it. He has to kill himself. And the cycle continues.
Yep. That's why you got to pay attention to what your kids are doing after school, folks. They might become a vampire familiar.
Yeah, I noticed like Oscar's parents, you know, sometimes they're good, but a lot of times you get the idea that they mostly just kind of ignore him. Like, I don't even know if they have a scene with like his mother's like head is cut off in a lot of the scenes to show you just like how alienated he is, you know, from his own family.
Oh, yeah. His parents are like pretty checked out. I mean, they're not the worst parents. They're not the best parents. They got lives of their own. You know, they're doing their best, but you kind of get the idea that they don't really want to deal with their kid and they've got other shit to do.
Yeah.
Especially when he goes to visit his dad and they're like playing a game together or something. And then his dad's friend comes over and he's like, oh, no, I'm just going to drink with my friend now.
Yeah.
Sorry. Oh, maybe his parents, if they paid a little more attention to him and what was going on and maybe ask questions instead of just taking it at face value when he's like, oh, this cut on my face. Oh, I fell. Like maybe they could have intervened, but it's too late. And he's starting a new life now. So sorry.
All right. And next up we have Byzantium from 2012. Neil Jordan, our boy. From Interview with the Vampire, which I feel still might be my favorite vampire movie of all time. I think he, you know, did it again with Byzantium. It's not as good as Interview with the Vampire, but it's still very, very good. And, you know, he does a new kind of a new twist on it. The romance, the teen vampire romance in this is not between Brad Pitt and the 13-year-old is between two, you know, teenagers. So it's not nearly as weird and creepy. But yeah, I really, really, really like this movie. And I wonder what you thought of it on the whole, Jamie.
Oh, yeah. I liked it a lot. I really like how he always explores, like, the human parts of a vampire or just, you know, what it would be like on a really psychological level to be dealing with eternal life, loneliness, and all of the issues that that brings up. Also, I can't help but think about Lady Bird, because that's the other thing that I've seen. I don't know how you pronounce her name.
Saoirse Ronan
in. And I feel like this movie would be really good, like, interspersed with scenes from Lady Bird. Like, Lady Bird's a vampire. That's a normal part of being a teenage girl. She fights with her mother. She falls in love. It's like the same movie.
Yeah, I mean, it does share that, you know, part of it, which probably more annoying when she's a vampire, because she's been pulling this shit for 200 years.
Yeah.
You know, she has been, you know, annoying and down on her mother, even though her mother is sacrificing so much for her and doing so much for her and doesn't know how to do any better. And she just like sits in judgment of her the entire time for 200 years. Imagine having to raise a teenage daughter for 200 years.
I will not. I will not, sir. That sounds terrible. I mean, I'm not even sure I want to do it for like the normal amount of time. So props to Clara for making it work for so long.
You know, so this film is about, you know, Eleanor and Clara, a daughter and mother, you know, and what I like about this film is that it really tries to be like a feminist sort of vampire film, because they're not supposed to be vampires, because in this universe, in the Byzantine universe, only men get to be vampires, and they were able, and upper class men at that, you know, Clara and was able to kind of, because she was, you know, someone who was brutally abused, forced into prostitution, but she, you know, kept her wits about her. And when she saw this opportunity to become a vampire, she stole it from these men and made herself a vampire. And then when they tried to get revenge on her by infecting her daughter with syphilis, she then saved her daughter and turned her into a vampire as well. And they've been on the run from this cabal of sexist male vampires ever since.
Yeah, these guys are clearly pieces of shit. They're a brotherhood of gentlemen. They call themselves the pointed nails of justice, which is exactly what some stuck-up pricks like that would call themselves. It's fucking stupid, and she knows it. And eventually, she has the last laugh. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. The film jumps between when Clara... showing Clara's history and them in the modern day, like they're fully in like the real world. Like it opens up with Clara working in a strip club, and then I think London, or
I'm not sure where they are when they start out, but they move really fast to a seaside town called Hastings.
In Hastings, yeah. Similar to the vampires in Let the Right One In, they're poor vampires, which means they have to constantly, they never have any money. They don't have castles or anything of that nature that they can retreat to. They still have to work for a living, or at least steal for a living. I think Clara prefers working. She is a businesswoman, after all. And so she finds this guy in the club who has a hotel that he's just lost, and he's got a bunch of mommy issues, and she's like, I'll be your mommy if you want.
Oh, yeah.
And then moves it to the hotel and promptly turns it into a brothel.
Oh yeah. I mean, you could tell from the very beginning when she meets him and she's like $50 for blowjob, and then he just all of a sudden starts crying and talking about his mom. It's like, oh, this is a guy who she can play like a fiddle. This is a Captain Save-A-Ho, you know? He wants to take care of her. He wants to rescue her from the life that she's leading of being a sex worker, and creates a really nice opening to just move into his cool, creepy guest house and make a brothel there.
Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah, I just happen to own a hotel. It's a little bit dilapidated now because my mother passed away. Would you like to stay in it? And she's just like on it immediately. Mm-hmm. She is a straight up hustler. I love her character. And I actually hate how angry, you know, her daughter always is. I mean, understandable, you know, being a teenager for 200 years would suck too. But Clara is like vampire Eileen Wuornos or something like that. She is just like, is willing to, you know, do anything to, you know, survive. And she's just a survivor, and she has been for all these hundreds of years. And she's, you know, even stealing immortality from, you know, these stuck up assholes. She's just a wonderful character. She's a badass vampire. I think more people should stand her.
Hell yeah. She's also a sex worker. And it is nice to see a sort of semi-heroic depiction of a sex worker in the movies.
Yeah, even though her daughter is kind of judgmental of her, I don't feel like the movie is like she seems like good at her job and seems to like enjoy it or take pride in her work and her efforts. And even though she is playing, you know, the guy, she is generally really nice to him. You know, Noel is his name. He ends up dead by the end of the film because it's a vampire movie. Any innocent person around the vampire has to die. But, you know, I really think that she is more or less a pretty noble person.
Yeah.
And, like, I really liked her character.
She's a very human person as well, because it's important to see sex workers and vampires as, you know, complex human beings. So maybe she's got some bad qualities, too. Maybe she's got some good qualities. But I, too, respect her for just how hard she works to keep her daughter safe. Basically, and she doesn't want the same life for her daughter either. She keeps her separated. She tries to keep her out of all the shit that she's doing, and she just wants her to like go to college and, you know, be a normal 200-year-old teen, which I think is very nice.
Yeah, it is funny that she, the daughter at 200 years goes to college. At least she doesn't go to high school like that fucking creep from Twilight. Mm-hmm. Like, come on, dude.
I actually looked it up because I was confused about what I thought college might mean something else to British people. And it turns out what they're usually referring to when they say college is not university, like we would think of like a 4-year university that you start when you're 18, but it's actually kind of a school in between high school and university where kids go from like age 16 to 18 or so, where they can do all the A levels and have a little more autonomy. There's not like that in loco parentis as much as you would see in high school. Although, as we'll see later in the movie, the teachers still get nosy, and that's where they fuck up.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a maybe like a community college, like a 2-year like community college you might do before going to university.
It's England is weird.
And so while, you know, Eleanor is off, you know, being a mopey teen, she finds an even mopier teen named Frank, played by Caleb Landry Jones. Now, this actor, you know, he always looks deathly ill. In this film, he actually, his character is supposed to have leukemia, and so he's very sickly, and they fall in love with each other, and the entire time, like, she's just blabbing on and on about being a fucking vampire. Eleanor will not stop talking to any, seemingly anyone she meets, but including Frank, about how the fact that she's 200 years old.
Yeah, that really feels like a bad call on her part, especially after her mom worked so hard to keep her safe and protect her.
Yeah, her mom decapitates someone in the first 10 minutes in order to protect them. And then the first boy she meets is like, oh, by the way, I'm a vampire.
Like, why would you do that? I mean, I get it. She wants to confess. She wants to tell the truth of her story. She keeps writing it down. Like, that's the thing that frames this whole movie, right? She's telling her story and then kind of crumples up the pages and throws them to the wind. I'm like, that's good. That's good that she's getting rid of it. But then she decides to go and write it all down and give it to him. And I guess he believes her, but then he fucking turns around and gives it to the teacher, which was not cool. Not cool. And then, of course, you know, what do you do when a teenage girl turns in this crazy fucking story? You go investigate, like, because it's supposed to be an autobiography, right? That was the assignment. That you go investigate, you're like, what's her home life like?
This eventually leads to the coven of sexist male vampires finding Clara and Eleanor. Basically, everyone has to die.
Well, first we have the one teacher, the male teacher, who goes to investigate. And I really thought that Clara was just going to do a really good job, like smooth talking him out of any suspicion. But instead, she fucking murks him.
Yes.
And then the nice lady teacher, who I recognized her from Orphan Black. I think that actress is in a lot of stuff, but she's like kind of a nice liberal, you know, she doesn't really know what she's getting herself into. She thinks that she can call, I guess, the cops or like some sort of government service to go in and like save this this poor child from what's happening to her. But then, of course, surprise, the cops are the Vampire Brotherhood. And like, she is just unceremoniously killed. And I had to laugh a little bit because I'm like, that's what happens when good liberals get nosy, you know?
Mind your business. Mind your business.
Mm-hmm. Like, calling the cops will never solve anything. And whether or not they're vampires, like, they're just not going to help you, generally speaking.
Yeah, and, you know, the big bad, you know, vampire shows up barking around, and he wants, what exactly do you want? He wants revenge, or, because they were super pissed at Clara for becoming a vampire, not just because, you know, she's a woman, but because she's a sex worker, and she's broke, and she's not upper class.
Like, lowborn.
Yeah, and the brethren want to kill Eleanor's daughter because she's even, you know, even lower on the totem pole as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, she was not supposed to make her into a vampire either.
Oh, not at all. But
and
somehow
then she killed one of them too, right?
Yeah, she did kill one of them.
So yes. She broke all of the vampire rules.
Yeah, like when do you have, when do you make these vampire rules? You know, like how, like is there like a committee? Because it feels like it's only three dudes. Like they could just like change the rules a little bit, but if we don't get really good clear sense of why these guys are like, we can't make any more new vampires, and they can't be women, and we're just going to be sexist assholes. But thankfully, you know, one of the male vampires kind of. Kind of has the same feeling. He wants to reform the coven, so Darvel, who's always, you know, felt kind towards Claire, even when she was young, before he let her, his brother, kidnap, rape, and sell her into sex slavery. He seems to still have fond feelings for her, even though he didn't do anything for her before that. He kills Savella, which is the big bad vampire, and in order to save Clara and Eleanor, he and Clara ride off into the sunset together, while Clara finally lets her daughter go and be with her and take her sickly boy to the vampire cave, where she turns him into a vampire.
Yep. I mean, what's eternal life without a vampire boyfriend? You gotta have one. Especially if he talks like an old man, that's like super hot.
See, but here's the thing though, like they don't know each other for that long. Like, are they really gonna want to spend forever with each other? I feel like, you know, as a mother, Clara was right to kind of want to put the squash on this, because you can't, like, these vampire relationships are very serious. Once the puppy love wears out, what do they have?
Yeah, well, this is a conversation many mothers have tried to have with their teenage daughters when they want to run off with some boy. They're like, this isn't love. You're just 16 and you're crazy and you don't know what you're doing. And like, I honestly think she had it right the first time when she went over to his house and she was like, let me in. And like, for a second, I was like, oh, is she being bad? Is she going to murder this poor sickly boy?
Yeah, she was thinking about killing him at some point. Yeah.
But then she realizes that Eleanor is in trouble, probably through, you know, the vampire psychic connection that she has with her daughter, and runs off to go save her. And after that happens, in the end, she's like, oh, you know, actually, you should leave the nest. So maybe it's not so much that she respects the relationship, but maybe she knows that that Lady Bird is now old enough to make her own mistakes and learn from doing.
And besides, you know, if Clara really needed to, she could probably kill Frank in the future if she hurts.
Oh yeah,
she could definitely take him out.
He's not that strong. Even as a vampire, I think Clara is a much older vampire than him and a much more experienced vampire. Yep. But it is nice when they go to the vampire bat cave, like the romantic in me is like, aw, they're going to be together forever, or, you know, however long this thing lasts. We didn't even talk about the vampire island that they go to. That was pretty
sick. Yeah, it's so cool. And the reason, like, it's such a different conception of how you become a vampire, and the visuals on it with like the blood waterfalls, like Neil Jordan, of course, is amazing filmmaker. I think I wish he made more stuff, but that those images just so great and powerful, and it looks so different than like what you normally see in vampire stuff. And I was kind of trying to figure out like, where did they get the idea that you become a vampire by getting taken to this mystical cave full of crows? And it turns out that this was originally a play that borrowed from a Caribbean lore and magic. So that's why that it didn't have that, it wasn't as a European type feel to how you become a vampire. It had more of like a Caribbean, like voodoo reference going on.
Cool. Very cool. I think they call it the Saint with No Name, right? Like there's this there a few different movies popped into my head watching this. Like you go into the cave, is it crows, is it bats, it's spooky, you meet the Saint with No Name that then looks like you. Right. Which reminds me of the movie Us. You meet yourself. The saint takes on your face and then kills you. And then you wake up and you're a vampire forever. It's pretty fucking sick.
Also similar to when Luke goes into the cave on Empire Strikes Back and meets Darth Vader. But Darth Vader has his face.
It also kind of reminded me of The Beach. Have you seen The Beach?
That's with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah. Tilda Swinton.
No, I haven't seen it.
There's like a map that you can, there's like a special secret map that you can use to find this special island in Thailand, and the secret of the beach is not that you become a vampire, you just get to like be on vacation forever. So that's it's a different twist.
All right, so Byzantium. This movie, I really, really enjoy this movie. It's a very fun, you know, romp. It looks beautiful. It looks gorgeous. If there's anything to knock it for, it's that, you know, seeing Saoirse Ronan, who looks, you know, who is not like a child, like, you know, in Interview with the Vampire, you know, you had this actual child throwing this temper tantrum. So you understand why she's so upset. But Saoirse Ronan, I feel sorry for her. I'm like, your mom is awesome. Like, leave her alone. Mm-hmm. And Lestat is like a piece of shit too, right? Like, Lestat is a piece of shit. And Louis is kind of this phony and this liar and this crybaby in his own right. While Clara is just like all around pretty awesome. Maybe she's not, you know, the best mother, but she is doing her best and she has done a lot. So I didn't feel the romance as much because I just didn't really think Eleanor was had anything to complain about in the first place.
Yeah, well, it just goes to show you, no matter how cool your parents are, you're probably going to be an asshole to them when you're a teenager.
Yeah.
That's just a fact of life. She was a really cool feminist too. Like, she killed abusive men. That's generally, yes. That was her mission. She said she was going to be the point of nail of justice for bad men. She kills bad men. Like, what's to hate about that?
She kills bad men, spares the few good ones she runs into, treats them very kindly and fairly. Like, she's a boss. She's a boss. I stand her. She is a queen.
Yeah. And even like poor Noel, that's his name. Like, she doesn't kill him, right? Like, he's like collateral damage.
Yeah, he is like collateral damage. And you do feel like she did kind of bring him into the world. But hey, those were the best, you know, weeks of his life, probably.
Yeah, sad but true. Maybe not sad, because she's like pretty hot and awesome and stuff.
Yeah,
and
he got to be with a vampire queen for a few weeks.
He got his groove back.
Who could ask for more?
Indeed. I'm sure Noel died happy that he had lived so much life.
In such a short time. Mm-hmm. That was Vampire Castle for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good one.
Peace.